Good evening and welcome to From the Frontline. I'm Hunter Combs in the studio with Dr. Hammond, and this evening we're going to be discussing the Holocaust in Rwanda that happened 27 years ago today. Dr. Hammond, thank you so much for joining us, but would you just introduce this topic for our listeners tonight?
Well, 27 years ago, I was walking knee-deep and ankle-deep and waist-high even in corpses and churches and hospitals, and it's unbelievable what was going on in Rwanda. It was one of the most nauseating, sickening, mind-numbing experiences of my life, was to see what was done in Rwanda and to document it and produce the book Holocaust in Rwanda. And as the subtitle says, the role of gun control, media manipulation, liberal church leaders in the United Nations, because actually those were the components that made this worst campaign of mass murder in living memory in Africa. In just 100 days, more people were slaughtered with machetes, pangas, than had died from atomic weapons in all of history. I mean, just consider that. That this is worse than Hiroshima. This is 10 times worse than Hiroshima. This is hundreds of thousands of people killed, low-tech, not bullets, not bombs, machetes. Just
pangas, as you'd call them here.
It's just a staggering, cutting instruments, low-tech genocide as it could possibly be. But that this was unleashed upon the Tutsi minority people of Rwanda. And what also was quite disturbing to me is that the media made it into something tribal, leaving out the religious dimension that the Tutsis being targeted were overwhelmingly Protestant Christians. And you get this misdirection where so many people saw it as, oh, just tribalism. You heard the media over and over again saying, the Hutus and the Tutsis are killing one another again, putting the victims and the culprits in one big batch.
You know, it's actually didn't know who blame was the victim. Killing who.
Yeah, well, that sort of attitude. And it wasn't that way. And then you had a whole lot of people talking about the war. It wasn't war. This was genocide. One side was disarmed and the other side was the government with massive international backing that was slaughtering these disarmed people. So what was going on there was cold-blooded, callous, colossal carnage. It was genocide. It was deliberate attempt to wipe out the people. And those people were overwhelmingly Christians. And the fact is, statistically, the vast majority of people killed were killed in churches, schools and hospitals, the vast majority. Wow. And of those, churches were the main venue. So you could not miss the anti-Christian nature of it. In one church, Natarama, that I walked in, over 1,200 corpses within the church walls. And there were decapitated skulls on the church pulpit up front, on the Lord's table, the altar up front. And that was common in many of these sites. So you couldn't mistake the message. This was an anti-Christian genocide. And yet the average group did not refer to it as persecution of Christians or anything like this. They just referred to it as tribal violence or the war, which is such a distortion of reality.
Oh, my word. It just shows the depravity of man. It says that, this is a quote from the Canadian general Romeo Dallaire, "I know there is a God because in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil. I have seen him, I have smelt him, and I have touched him. I know that devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." But his experience here with seeing this evil really just showed him the depravity of, well, what he said later, that humanity has failed Rwanda, the failure of humanity in Rwanda. And it shows it's not really the failure of humanity, it's just the depravity of man. It's actually man doing what man has done since the fall, being evil and sinful and wicked. And as God said in Noah's day, the thoughts of man's heart is continually evil all the day long. And so it's really just shows the depravity of man. But it's interesting. I would just be curious to find out a little bit more. So why did this genocide take place then? Was it government persecution against the Christians? Was it what exactly led to it, if it wasn't tribalism specifically?
Well, there was a tribal aspect, but that's not the sole nor primary focus. Now, I went to Rwanda. I interviewed survivors. I spoke to prisoners. I actually got into the prison and distributed Bibles to the genocidal lunatics, the Interahamwe, who had been guilty of this and who are waiting execution for that matter, and just read Bibles to them. So I got to speak to people on all sides. And I studied books like Rwanda, A Waste of Hope, which was about the United Nations human rights field operations, Rwanda, Death, Despair, and Defiance. And I think one of the very helpful books in particular was this one by Romeo Dallaire, Shake Hands with the Devil, which has also been made into a dramatic film, which is one of the most helpful films on what happened there. And unlike Hotel Rwanda, which is the Hollywood version, all filmed in South Africa. You could see the roads, everything South African. It doesn't look like Rwanda. And there's not a Rwandese in the film. The Hotel Rwanda film, they've got Americans and South Africans playing Rwandese. It's just, no, come on. So I couldn't take it seriously. And there's not a hint in it of Christianity. You are meant to believe that there's people being slaughtered by the hundreds of thousands. And there's over 1,000 refugees hiding in this hotel. And nobody's praying. There's no hymns being sung. There's no Bibles being read. There's no faith being expressed. And there's no indication in the film, and which is why I think Hotel Rwanda is an extremely dishonest film. It's more like a misdirection, distraction from the reality of what happened. It doesn't let you know. Whereas the Shake Hands with the Devil was filmed in Rwanda with Rwandese at the sites. In fact, the hair in the back of my head stood up because it was there. It was at ETO.
You actually remember seeing those sites when you were there.
Yes, at those very churches and sites. And Romeo Dallaire, the general who was in charge of the United Nations forces in Rwanda, UNMIR, United Nations mission to Rwanda, he oversaw the production of the film too, which was based on his book. And then there's another very helpful film, which is Shooting Dogs, which was released in America as Beyond the Gates. Now, the title, Shooting Dogs, is quite disgusting, but it's a explanation of the United Nations rules of engagement. So it was based around what happened at ETO, the Escole Technique official or the technical school, which had been turned into United Nations refugee camp. And so there were thousands of Rwandese, Tutsis, seeking refuge from the UN. So the UN forces were protecting them there. And a BBC news reporter, David Belton, who was in there, gives the story. And this film also was filmed in Rwanda with Rwandese in the actual places based on the missionary who died with them after they were betrayed and abandoned by the United Nations in the most treacherous way. And the title, Shooting Dogs, is referring to the action of the United Nations who shot stray dogs that scavenged the bodies of the dead. And since the United Nations force were not allowed to shoot at the Hutu mass murderers who were causing the deaths in the first place, the shooting of dogs was symbolic of the madness of the situation and the insanity of the United Nations rules of engagement. Oh, you're not allowed to shoot the people who are killing the people, but you can shoot the dogs who are
eating the bodies.
Oh, and word. So this kind of insanity, which is why, but I don't think the title Shooting Dogs endeared the film to many people. I mean, people love animals like myself.
Yeah.
Find it an offensive film, but the offensive title, but the title was meant to provoke, like, what?
Yeah, why would you call it that?
they're killing hundreds of thousands of people, and all the UN's allowed to do is shoot the dogs who are scavenging and not the people who are causing the mass murder, which is insane. So to try and make sense of this Rwandan Holocaust, one needs to understand that General Romeo Dallaire, who was the Canadian general in charge of the United Nations mission to Rwanda, of course he is directly under Secretary of the Security Council, which was Kofi Annan at that time. And he was at that point also the Cameroonian member, a foreign minister, was also his direct supervisor on the ground. Well, interestingly, General Romeo Dallaire knew of the stockpiling of weapons. He had informed the UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali of this. And in fact, talk about conflicts of interest. Boutros-Ghali, who then was Secretary General of the UN, had been Egyptian foreign minister and just shortly before had facilitated a large sale of arms from Egypt to the MRND dictatorship in Rwanda prior to the genocide, when they already had a track record of regular genocide. This wasn't the first genocide. This was just the biggest. And Egypt was selling weapons to them. And the Secretary General of the UN had facilitated these sales. Goodness. So that's a bit bizarre. And around these armed forces was expanding rapidly, trebling in size, receiving a lot of training and weapons from the French government. Well, from March 1993, the MRND government began compiling lists of traitors who they planned to kill. They meticulously marked the addresses of every single Hutu. Tutsi or Hutu who was sympathetic to or married to a Tutsi. And the Radio Television Libre de Mille Colines, or RTLM, kept broadcasting mixture of tribal propaganda, music, obscene jokes about the Tutsi, continually inciting the Hutu majority to hate, to despise, and to want to massacre the Tutsi minority, even bring out a new Ten Commands, which included that you're not to have friends amongst the Tutsi, you're not to be employed by the Tutsi, all the way down to you must kill them. So hundreds of thousands of machetes were imported from Red China. And the Interahamwe party thugs of the MRND who were armed with AK-47s and helped distribute these massive quantities of machetes throughout the country in preparation for the genocide. Now, General Deliere was well-informed. He knew that this was coming. He knew where the stockpile was. And even before they had distributed this massive shipment from Red China of machetes, which were the primary weapons going to be, he informed the Secretary General of these ominous developments. And he didn't seek permission because he was head of the peacekeeping force. He was going to confiscate this massive stockpile in the warehouse before it could be distributed. But he just informed his superiors, Kofi Annan, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, is going to do it. He didn't think he needed to ask for permission. But on his way, he's ordered to cease and desist and to stand down. Mm. And direct order from Kofi Annan, confirmed by the Secretary General, do not intervene, do not interfere, do not take any of these machetes. And he was stunned. How could he be forbidden to intervene? What's he there for? I'm here running a peacekeeping mission. How can I possibly not confiscate these machetes, which we know are here for only one reason?
Mm.
And then, he warned. He said, when people said, did they know, could they have stopped it? In fact, General Deliere says, yes, we informed. I personally informed, he said, Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State at the time. He had the information. He knew about it. He knew that Bill Clinton was informed of this final solution to exterminate all the Tutsis. Well before, he said months before, he had informed General Secretary of the United Nations, that's Boutros-Ghali, the head of the Security Council, Kofi Annan, Madeleine Albright, the American ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Clinton, White House, they all were informed. They knew this was coming. And not only did they do nothing, they did everything they could to undermine the UNIMIR, United Nations mission to Rwanda, and General Deliere. Every request General Deliere gave was frustrated. They didn't receive the food they needed, the fuel they needed, the weapons they needed, the equipment, the ammunition, not even armored personnel carriers, which they ordered. And the United Nations procrastination and obstructionism and the United States State Department interference caused, as he documented, intense suffering, unnecessary deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and starvation of tens of thousands in the UN bases, which were meant to be sanctuaries for the refugees fleeing the killing. And that's all bad enough, but the biggest complicity in this all was actually of the role of France. The French government, their aid to the genocide defies belief. The French government, this is under François Mitterrand, who was, by the way, a Communist Party member of France, he provided vast quantities of weapons and numerous military advisors and technical assistance to the Rwandese armed forces before and during the genocide. On the 22nd of June, as the Tutsi-led Rwandese Patriotic Front turned the tide and began to liberate the country, now these were the resistance of the Rwandese Tutsis who were living in refugee camps in neighboring Uganda. When the genocide began, they were stunned. They knew they had to do something. They thought something would be done by United Nations or the Americans, but when nothing was done, they knew they had to do something. But what could they do? There were just a few people. And here's the MRND government of Rwanda with massive Libyan support, massive French support. How are they going to possibly beat them? But as they attacked, the Hutu MRND government, the Interahamwe, fled. And so as they were surprisingly liberating the country, France finally intervenes. They launch Operation Turquoise, creating a safe zone into which the Hutu armed forces and the Interahamwe mass murderers, the genocidaries, could flee. And then behind this military screen, they created a safe zone into which the genocide architects and operators could flee, and then they withdrew to the Zaire border, which Congo today, but then was called Zaire, where they received generous quantities of foreign aid and caused even more massacres, which led to the Great Lakes Wars of 1996 to 1997, in which 12 African nations' armed forces became embroiled in what many people called Africa's war, and millions more died. Possibly up to 12 million more died in the Great Lakes War, which was a ripple effect of allowing these genocidal maniacs not only to survive. And the French government provided that. And even to this day, there are architects of the genocide who are living under the protection of the French government or in Canada. Mm. And those countries signed the anti-genocide treaty, but in practice, they haven't done anything. And so when the French foreign minister was challenged, how could you be helping the genocidaries, as they'd call them, in Rwanda? The French foreign minister's response was, we were holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa.
Mm.
Translation, the Hutu mass murderers of Rwanda spoke French, but the Tutsi, because they had fled so many massacres before, they had fled into neighboring Uganda, and the refugee camps, they were being taught English. And so many of the Tutsi were English-speaking, whereas the vast majority of the Hutu were French-speaking. So, hey, okay, they're genocidaries, but they're French-speaking genocidaries, so that makes it okay. Literally, that was the explanation of the French government. And to this day, there are people that the Rwandese government have summoned, that they want them handed over for extradition, that they can be tried in Rwanda, that the French government provides protection. They don't even hand them over to The Hague in Holland, where they could be judged at the International Criminal Court, for example. They are still protecting architects of the genocide because they're Francophone Africa. So you can understand why, when the Rwandese Tutsis liberate the country and stop the genocide, why they abolished French as a national language and made English the official language of Rwanda and kicked the United Nations out.
Sure. So why did this genocide take place? I mean, I've seen the movie Beyond the Gates and Hotel Rwanda and all these things, and I think, yeah, the question that's never answered, and many times even as someone taking in media, you don't even think to ask these questions, but why did it take place? Was it a communist anti-Christian agenda? Was it, you said it's not just ethnic cleansing, but was it ethnic cleansing? Yeah, why did this take place? I mean, clearly there was so much intentionality put in. Let's kill the Tutsi, but why?
Right. Well, of course, it's insane. It doesn't make much sense to those of us who believe in good neighborliness with different people around us.
Yeah.
But their mentality was the Tutsi are taller. The Tutsi are thinner. The Tutsi are ethnically slightly different from the Hutu. The Hutu are more pastoralists. They are the ones who are tilling the soil. The Tutsi are more the cattle herders, the shepherds and so on. The Tutsi are meant to have migrated something like 500 years ago from Abyssinia, what today is Ethiopia. Mm. And they look like they've got more Ethiopian features somewhat. And so even though they've been here 500 years, they're considered as invaders and colonists, and they were being denigrated, even though now they had, of course, tended to be the leaders of the country. In fact, the kings of both Rwanda and Burundi were always Tutsi. That's going back a long way. In fact, if you ever saw the King Solomon's mines of 1950s, they ended up in the Tutsi. It was definitely Tutsi style and dancing and everything, where they claimed this is King Solomon's mines. But anyway, that was filmed in Rwanda. So the Tutsi are visibly different. Mm. And because they were mostly Protestant, they tended to have a far higher literacy rate, a far higher educational standard, far higher income, and there was a lot of things to be greedy about. So the communists came in and exploited this. Mm-hmm. There was class mixed with race and tribalism, greed, resentment for the Tutsi. They used to be your leaders, and now we've got one man, one vote. Well, once. And then they have a one-party dictatorship, and you've got no more choice. But in this whole environment, and the Tutsi still seemed to thrive, and the Hutu were being whipped up by the Marxists to despise and hate them and resent them as the reason why they were in trouble. Of course, the reason why they were struggling is because of corruption and incompetence by the government and communist and socialist tactics. But nevertheless, What she also had aggravating it was animism. So secular humanism, Marxism, tribalism, and then animism. Animism tends to be very susceptible to witchcraft leanings. And so there was all of this combining in a so-called perfect storm of hatred for the Protestant, Christian, Tutsi, upper class, intelligentsia, who are better off, who most of the teachers and so on and so forth. And this was then exploited by the government, the MRND government, which was very unpopular, very oppressive, and they needed to blame someone. And so what better than to blame the minority? It's the minority's fault why things are going wrong in the country. And the man who really set things rolling is President Juvenal Habyarimana. Now, Habyarimana was the president, and he was actually at that moment in April. We normally date the Rwandan Holocaust from the 6th of April, because 6th of April 1994, 27 years ago exactly, the Holocaust was launched. And the trigger for it was the assassination of President Juvenal Habyarimana. And as his presidential plane was coming in, he was shot down. Now, it was proven by research by the Belgians and others. It was a French heat-seeking missile fired by his own presidential guard from within the originating from within the presidential grounds that brought down his plane, which incidentally is the only time in history that two presidents have been assassinated simultaneously. Hmm. There's the president of neighboring Burundi and, of course, the president of Rwanda in the plane at the same time. Now, the amazing thing is Habyarimana had started the whole ball rolling for the genocide planning. But at one point, as people must have thought, he would be an excellent sacrificial lamb pretext for launching this. Mm. And so even though he got the ball rolling, he couldn't have realized he'd be the first victim of the whole genocide. Mm. And of course, they tried to blame this on the Tutsi, but the evidence was just overwhelming. It was French heat-seeking missile fired from his own presidential guard within their own area. This is obviously a false flag operation. But the moment his plane came down, the government forces set up a dense network of roadblocks, mobilized Interahamwe mobs to systematically go house to house, massacring all Tutsis. At roadblocks, everyone identifies Tutsi, pulled out, hacked to death on the spot, bodies piled up there. And this is what is documented in films like Shooting Dogs and what was happening in Shake Hands of Devil. So how this all happened, at that moment, there were 7.3 million people in the population. 84% were Hutu, 15% were Tutsi, and 1% were Twa, smaller tribe. And today, I don't know how many are Tutsi, but it's probably down to around 10%, but nobody dares do calculations. It's human rights, African rights, calculated 750,000 murdered. That was the first estimate that came out. The United Nations mission estimated the toll to over 800,000. Now, if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Kigali, which I've done, they've got the names of 1,171,000 who were killed, 90% of which were Tutsi. And the Genocide Museum in Kigali, which I've examined, calculates that during the 100 days of the genocide, it was an average of 10,000 murdered every day, 400 every hour, 7 every minute. And there were over 400,000 orphans alive at the end who'd lost both their parents.
Oh, my word. This is horrific on a mass scale. Wow. So you say that the Tutsis were Protestant. Were the Hutu then, were they Roman Catholic? Were they Protestant as well?
No. The Hutus overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. But when you say Roman Catholic, it's more of a syncretism with witchcraft.
Yeah, so doesn't mean these animism. Were devout Roman Catholics.
No, not at all. In fact, I would say it's akin to what you get in Brazil, where you get quite a lot of voodooism, or in Haiti, where there's quite a lot of Buddhism and Catholicism mixed. So it's not Orthodox Catholicism by any means. But in fact, there were Catholics who were butchered because they were either Tutsi or because they were married to a Tutsi. Hmm. So they were that brutal that it wasn't just the Tutsis they were after, but any Hutu who was seen to be a friend of the Tutsi.
Hmm.
For example, if you were a Hutu and you worked for a Tutsi, that would be enough to have you targeted. Hmm. If you have married, well, of course, I mean, gee, then a Hutu married to a Tutsi was targeted for death in the worst way. So there was a tribal element, but it was more than a coincidence that tribal minority targeted were overwhelmingly Protestant Christians.
Hmm. So what ended up coming in after this? What was their end goal of slaughtering the Tutsi, was there a new government they wanted to instate? Was there new sort of a, yeah, what was the end goal of their genocide?
Yeah, so what had happened is from independence, when the Belgians left 1962, there was a lot of massacres. Now, the Tutsi had been the ones ruling because they had a monarchy, and the Belgians tended to work through indirect rule. And so the Tutsi tended to be the ones who, they were the administrators, they were the teachers, they were the policemen, they were the army, they were just about everything. And so the Tutsi were the ones that were perceived as, they're the ones that the Belgians turned to because they were the natural leaders who had always traditionally been leaders. I don't think they understood all the tribal dynamics. But in came communism mixed with animism in the 1960s already and turned it into a class war, racial war, tribal war. And so the Tutsi got massacred repeatedly through the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so after a while, they formed a Tutsi resistance movement that was, in fact, making some strides. When a ceasefire was called in 1993 and the United Nations came in to supervise ceasefire, and as part of the ceasefire, they disarmed the people, all the people, especially the Tutsi. And many of the Tutsi laid down their weapons, understanding, well, the United Nations is going to protect us, so you know that's okay, that's not a problem. Now, of course, there were some who didn't believe this and who stayed over the border in Rwanda, in the Rwandese refugee camps under the protection of President Museveni of Uganda, who, by the way, had a Tutsi mother. And so he is sympathetic to them and gave them sanctuary. So the Tutsi were winning the war on the ground when a ceasefire was negotiated, and in came the United Nations, who disarmed everyone, which was going to guarantee peace and everyone would live happily ever after, theoretically. But what the conspirators planning this night of the long knives, literally, to kill off their hated minority, who they were using as the scapegoats for anything that was wrong in the country because of their government failures, they believed what they would then have an ethnically cleansed Rwanda with only Hutus, no Tutsis. It would be tribally homogeneous, and they would be able to continue the one-party state rule without any interference. Mm. And for this, they seemed to have the support of the French government and the Libyan government of Gaddafi, who was supplying them generously with weapons. This was the goal. And by the way, you know that they timed it with a look to international events. So what was going on in April 1994? Well, in South Africa, we were having the 1994 elections.
Yeah.
Mandela was campaigning to be president. It was South Africa's first one-man, one-vote elections. Mm. All the African correspondents and war correspondents in Africa were in South Africa. And so there was actually only two international journalists in the whole of Rwanda when the genocide locked in. And so they knew that they had at least a month or two that they could do anything they wanted when the world's attention would be so hysterically focused on South Africa that they could do anything at once. So there was a deliberate timing, orchestrating of this genocide to syncretize with what was going on in South Africa, knowing that the way the world media is, it tends to focus at some big thing at a time, and then you can do almost anything else while everyone's distracted. And that's when, right from the beginning, as the genocide occurred, there was a lot of confusion. So that most people wouldn't know what was happening, they isolated the victims by imposing a news blackout, they cut the telephone links, they established a dense network of roadblocks, they imposed nationwide curfew. And this kept people in their homes and prevented most people from fleeing. And by cutting communications and restricting travel, they isolated the victims and stifled the flow of news. Of course, this is before cell phones, and you know, everyone's depends on just telephone lines. And the few journalists, well, the two journalists that there were in the whole country, they were stuck in a hotel in Kigali. They didn't know what was going on in the countryside, which is where most of the genocide was taking place at first. And so the government then comes out with more disinformation by saying, we need foreign aid to help the victims of the war. There was no war.
Genocide.
Exactly. And so the very people carrying out the genocide were asking for foreign aid to help the victims. And so there was
That's cheeky.
It took a minimum of 6 weeks before the world really had an inkling of what was going on. Now, of course, the UN people on the ground, like General Romeo Dallaire, they knew what was going on much quicker. But they were going through the channels, and Kofi Annan, Boutros Ghali were just covering it up because it didn't fit the narrative. And we don't want to distract South Africa's moment of glory from Mandela. So And what made it worse is that the U.S. State Department would not accept, even when the word was coming out and General De Lier saying, this is genocide, the U.S. State Department would not allow the word genocide to be used and said, no, that word's only reserved for Jewish people, Second World War, you're not allowed to use the word genocide. But they're throwing the Rwandans alive into flaming pits.
You mean they weren't allowed to use the word Holocaust or genocide?
They couldn't use the word genocide or Holocaust.
Oh, really?
Wow. It was, and the U.S. State Department was blocking it. And they said for weeks, no, months, the U.S. State Department prevented any action, just quibbling over the terms being used. And you get this frustration coming out from General Romeo Dallier's book, Shake Hands with Devil. He surely was not just thinking of the Interahamwe people he is dealing with. Unfortunately, some of his superiors.
Oh, my word. So just thinking about this, I mean, these are such incredible atrocities that took place. Obviously, it seems like the Holocaust in Rwanda could have been prevented had General Dallier actually stood up and done something about it. And as
he wanted to, but he said they didn't have so much as a second clip of ammunition. He said he had no spare money. If they start a firefight, he said, we didn't have the means to continue the firefight, let alone have a second one. He had one clip of ammunition in his automatic. He had no spare ammunition. They didn't have the armored cars. They didn't have anything that they needed. What they'd been asked for, they didn't even have food to feed the people who were fleeing to them for sanctuary. Tens of thousands of refugees filling the soccer stadium in Kigali and others where they were being told by Butchus Ghali and Madeleine Albright and so on, just leave, just walk out. But what about the people who've come to us for safety? Doesn't matter. That's their problem. Leave them behind. And in fact, he was forced to leave in many cases where government said, we're pulling our troops out, like the Belgians pulled their troops out after 11 of their men got slaughtered. They handed over the weapons when requested to by the Interahamwe mass murderers in the middle of a genocide, and then they got hacked to death while alive. So Belgium said, well, that's it, we're not helping. And you start to have Pakistan, others pulling out the people, the Moroccans. And so General Dallier's got more and more of his troops being withdrawn, and he's not getting the aid. And so at different times they were pulling back. And, of course, what happens as they withdraw from an area? Well, in move the Interahamwe, and they slaughter all the Tutsi who'd been finding sanctuary, who've been concentrated in this point, thinking they were going to be protected by the UN. But without the UN providing them with food or medicines, how could they continue to do this? And at the same time, he said the French government was flying in empty planes to fly out families of the genocidal lunatics organizing this. And they could have been bringing in at least resupplies for them, but they didn't bring in a bullet or a bandage, nothing to help them. And what he's got to say is such a severe indictment, not only on the United Nations and the U.S. State Department and the French government, particularly the French government, but on so many aspects of the dishonesty. So understand General Romeo Dallier. He's a secular humanist. Mm. He's a globalist. He believes in the New World Order. He believes that the UN's there to make people's lives better. Mm. He believes he is going there to save lives, to protect people, to stop war, to preserve peace. So you can imagine how shattered this man was. I mean, he ended up an alcoholic lying on a park bench in Canada, picked up by the police. That's how wrecked he was from this. And he had to put the story down to get over the crisis.
His guilt and everything,
He says greatest regret of his life is that he didn't disobey orders, save lives. Even if I spent the rest of my life in prison, he said, at least I'd have a clear conscience.
Sure. And that's why he said humanity failed Rwanda. Because his worldview is humanism and the goodness of humanity. we actually saw a biblical worldview coming through where man is actually evil, not good.
So that's the subtitle of his book, The Failure of Humanity. But interesting enough, 10 years after the genocide in Rwanda, Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General, a man most of the Security Council, I should say, he was in charge of the Security Council at that point, so he's under Butchus Ghali as the Secretary General. But Kofi Annan, who was direct superior of UNIMIR Commander Romeo Dallier, he was finally cornered by the Rwandese to make an admission of guilt. And his admission of guilt was classic. The world failed you. Not I failed you. Not the UN failed you. Not the Security Council failed you. The world failed you. Now, that's classic secular humanism for not taking personal responsibility.
So what I mean, just thinking back on this, and this isn't the only genocide that's taken place either, but I mean, what steps should we take to ensure that these atrocities don't happen again? Because certainly as Christians, the Bible certainly has principles that we must live by in order to protect innocent life, to stop things like this from happening today. Yeah, so what would sort of your wisdom
well,
be on that
I mean,
front?
You can be sure that occupied my mind a lot. Without a doubt, there's an international moral obligation, there's a legal obligation to bring those responsible for the atrocities in Rwanda before courts of justice. And horrific crimes were committed, and there's mountains of evidence accumulated to extradite the architects of the genocide from Congo, from Tanzania, from Kenya, from Belgium, from Cameroon, from France, Canada, and the United States. There are mass murderers who should be tried in the Rwandese Court of Justice. With full respect for due process law, with international observers, of course, before the Rwandese people. But even more important than concerns for retribution and justice is the urgent need to lay solid foundations for the future that'll prevent such nationwide oppression from ever occurring again. And there's biblical principles that would enable one to deal with this. And the first thing is the Bible and history confirms human nature is basically selfish, depravity of man. And because of this, we need a form of government with strict enough laws and punishments to deter criminal behavior. But civil government needs to be powerful enough to restrain the evil impulse of sinful people. But as power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, rulers cannot be trusted with absolute power either. So the biblical solution is not the pagan Greek utopia of democracy where man rules, 51% can oppress the rest, but where law rules. We're meant to have a constitutional republic, lex rex, the law is king. And so Christians need to strive to build nations upon the unchangeable laws of God's word. Instead of rulers, we need elected servants, civil servants, bound down by the chains of the constitution. And we need to seek to erect systems of checks and balances to divide power, divide responsibility between executive, legislative, judicial branch of government with upper and lower house. We need checks and balances. You cannot allow power to accumulate in the hands of a few. It'll be abused. I mean, we know that that's history. And being cautious of human nature, especially human nature, foreign powers too, one needs a strong military defense as a deterrent against attacks and to preserve liberty and security for the people. But more important than that, I mean, here the government organized the killing of a minority. So a well-regulated militia composed of all the people as a trained to arms is the proper natural safe defense of a free nation, like Switzerland. Switzerland doesn't have an army. Switzerland has an army. And the right of people to keep and bear suitable weapons for defense should not be infringed. And the standing military is there to secure the rights of the people with respect to foreign aggressors. But the National Defense Force must be subject to elected civilian control. But as a safeguard against abuse by central government, local militias, commandos, you could call them in the South African sense, but the local National Guards need to be independent of the National Defense Force, controlled by the local communities, municipalities, local governments, and so on. And all law-abiding citizens must have the right to obtain, own, carry, use legal firearms to defend life and liberty. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. I mean, we need to remember every genocide of the 20th century, starting with the Turkish genocide of the Armenian Christians in 1915 on, through the Soviet Union, Red China. They all begin with gun control, gun registration, gun confiscate. Because just like criminals prefer disarmed victims, tyrants and dictators prefer disarmed citizens who are subjects and slaves, actually. So it's impossible for any police force to always guarantee the safety of every citizen. So no hindrance should be placed upon the right of a law-abiding citizen to obtain and use firearms for self-defense. I think a lot of violent crimes and certainly genocides would be prevented if people were not denied access to basic weapons of defense. And so disarming the potential victims of crime only serves the purpose of the criminals. And if a government fears the citizens, then that government can't be trusted with power.
Would this, do you think this would work in Africa, thinking about just arming the people and say you have an armed population who are ready with all the tribalism and this person stole my cow, so we're going to go back and sort of get revenge on them. And you have all these sort of honor killings and all this sort of tribal battles and things, would this work, do you think, with an armed population, or would there have to be other safeguards in place?
There are dangers, but yes, that's why we need other safeguards. So what we need is we need clearly separate government powers and functions. We need decentralization. We need as decentralized a government structure as possible. Switzerland, Singapore being nice examples from a free market system to where the local people have the power, where it's not centralized in any big group. And that should include on the local levels too, because an armed society can be a polite society if the people are free and there's free flow of information. Of course, in a context of evangelism, discipleship, this will work the best. We need thoroughly evangelized, well-discipled people for a free society, because otherwise, as you say, this could easily be abused. And so looking at what happened in Rwanda, my natural inclination is to say, if we could have had the people armed, this could not have happened. But I recognize there could be other problems of lesser but still unacceptable level of loss of life if you start to have people waging wars against their neighbors over cattle grazing grounds, and your cattle ate my crops and so on. And we know of cases where that's happened. Obviously, I ended my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, with this section on Foundations for Freedom and Justice, which is just a summary of the bigger book, Biblical Principles for Africa. And I think we've got to come back to all the different principles that we see in the Bible of being able to have education controlled by the parents, aided by the church, but independent of the state. And all these principles will help in being able to lay the solid foundations. As we can see, the freest societies in the world and the societies with the highest standard of living are the societies which have been implementing biblical principles the most. And I could just point to Switzerland again as a very good example.
Amen. Well, thank you so much. What are some resources? You mentioned the Holocaust in Rwanda and Biblical Principles for Africa book that you produced. Are there other resources that people could get a hold of that could help them as they think more about, well, what are some of these sort of safeguards, or what are some of the things we should be looking out in that these genocides don't happen, and also that we can protect our populations in the country?
Certainly. So I've written Holocaust in Rwanda. It's 70 pages with 20 photographs. It's in English and it's in French. So considering this happened in a French-speaking part of the world and most of the genocidal architects and the guilty parties are still living in French countries, French-speaking countries being protected, I thought so important to launch it in French. So I even went to Paris to launch this book in French. So Holocaust in Rwanda is available also as an ebook, and Biblical Principles of Africa is also available as an ebook, and it's also available in English and in French. We've also produced the Security and Survival Handbook, which is a good guideline on both protecting individuals, families, congregations, communities, farms. So Holocaust in Rwanda, highly recommend English and French. Also, if you go onto our frontlinemissionsa.org website, you'll find we've got a video on this presentation, which has got a lot of the pictures I took while I was in Rwanda at the time. And then we'd recommend the films Shake Hands with the Devil and Shooting Dogs or Beyond the Gates, which is the American title, as dramatic films that can help one to understand something of what was going on. But while those give a bit of an introduction, to understand what really happened behind the Holocaust in Rwanda book is key. And you'll find on the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism website and Facebook page, we've got articles, links, including to the audio and video. And there's a couple of articles I've written. One is Lessons from the Rwandan Holocaust. Another one, which is related, is Hotel Rwanda, Genocide in a Gun-Free Land, and then there is the Holocaust in Rwanda 27 years ago. And then we've also got the Kofi Annan, the UN, the Rwandan Holocaust, and the Oil for Food Scandal, which is a whole other expose, which is worth understanding. So go on to the frontlinemissionsa.org website, look for the audios, videos, PowerPoints, links, and contact christianlibertybooks.co.za for the books in either French or English or ebooks.
Thank you so much. I think there's so much to learn from these tragic events, and especially thinking about our context in South Africa with all the threats of genocide, even as we've faced with, of course, Julius Malema.
Juju.
Julius Malema, kill the Boer, kill the farmer. I mean, there's so much very relevant information here. It's not just an event in 94. We need to be well-equipped and well-thought through these issues as we face them today. But I think there's also, we need to be sure we don't become hardened towards those who do hate us and do want to kill those under us. Rather, we should, as Jesus said, pray for those who persecute us. bless and do not curse. And Psalm 114 says, "Blessed be the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and the one in whom I take refuge." Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good night, and God bless.